Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one and they're all...
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner and that is Pete Seeger again, Little Boxes. He passed away Monday night and we are honoring him, one of the great American icons and social political figures and musicians in this country who always fought for human rights. And that piece, Little Boxes, was a song he wrote that was a song making fun of all the suburban developments that took place after World War II. Everything was beginning to look the same in America. What happened to us? One of my favorite songs, Little Boxes. Every time I don't want to see a development, I'll just sing Little Boxes. But right now we're going to sing with M.K. Asante in the studio now. Buck, a Memoir is his book. Obviously, one of our great professors here in creative writing and film at Morgan State University. And M.K., welcome. Good to have you with us, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. It's great to be here. That song actually also reminded me of Jack Kerouac had a book called Dharma Bums.
Right.
And in Dharma Bums, he talks about all the houses looking exactly the same with everybody
right.
inside the house thinking exactly the same thing at the same exact time. Like, it's a great thing, but yeah.
Good thing.
Yeah, great observation.
So this is our 20-minute version of a longer conversation we're going to have very soon.
Awesome.
Right?
Yep.
Because you're going to be speaking at Red Emmis tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, I'll be at Red Emmis tomorrow at 7. So I'm real excited about that because the last book I wrote is bigger than hip-hop. I actually wrote a good chunk of it in Red Emmis. You know, I would go to
right?
the coffee shop, yeah, and I would just, you know, write it. So yeah, it has a special history.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
This book is like, it's, you know, I mean, it's a young man's memoir. You probably have another one in you later on, but
yeah.
It's a young man's memoir. One of the things I thought about when you write, because you wrote in this book earlier about... Philadelphia, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
and all I could think about was Bodymore, Murderland.
Yeah, yeah.
And the similarities between these worlds.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, coming from Philadelphia, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, now being in Baltimore, you know, I've seen the parallels and the similarities, and they are similar. They have some similarities. And so, yeah, but definitely, obviously, Killadel, Pennsylvania, you know, that just represents, you know, it's kind of a catchy name, but it represents something horrible, really. You know what I mean? It represents kind of just the senseless gun violence that goes on in our community. So, but that's what we called it growing up. You know, we called it Killadel. They still call it Killadel, Illadel, you know, all these names. And it kind of flies in the face of the whole notion of city of brotherly love. However, Buck is a story about brotherly love. You know, it's a story about family love. It's also a story about...
Literally brotherly love.
Brotherly love, literally.
Right.
You know, me and my big brother Uzi, you know, the color of walnuts with a long, sharp face like the African mask.
I love that piece when you wrote that. Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, so that's... I mean, it really is about our family and our struggles. You know, Frederick Douglass said, without struggle, no progress. So this book is definitely about struggle, but it's also about our progress.
One of the things that is a constant piece in this book to me is the subtext and part of the text as well. And it's really very powerful to me, and I think, because I've been talking about this for years, but I never could say it as clearly or eloquently as you did, nor with in the same way. When you talk about language and talk about, know what I mean? You mean that the people's our inability of young people in this society to think deeply because we don't teach language. So if you don't have the language, you can't develop a concept in depth. I mean, that's to me one of the great crimes that goes unseen, especially for young people of color in poor communities.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And in my own story, you know, Buck is obviously a memoir. It deals with my life growing up in Philadelphia between the ages of about 13 and 18. And it deals with a lot of struggles. You know, my brother in prison, incarcerated. My mom in and out of mental institutions. You know, trouble with my father and you know, him not being in the house. And
You came from an intellectual upper middle class family.
Not upper middle,
middle class,
but yeah, middle
father's
class.
Father's a university professor.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yep, activist. You know what I mean?
Right.
My parents were always activists, so we never had, you know, all their money went to the community, you know what I'm saying?
Right, that's right.
How they were oriented. But and I was born in Zimbabwe, you know, and
right.
we talk about that. I talk about that also in the book. But yeah, I mean, for me, it was language and literature that really was that key that emancipated me. I remember having an epiphany, and I talk about this in the book, you know, where I'm like, now I see why reading was illegal for black people right. during slavery. I discovered that I think in words. The more words I know, the more things I can think about. My vocab and thoughts grow together like the stem and petals of a flower. Reading was illegal because if you limit someone's vocab, you limit their thoughts. They can't even think of freedom because they don't have the language to. I think about all the brothers I know with limited vocabs, the one who keep asking, I mean, because they don't have the words to express what they really mean. You know, language for me became this thing where it was my liberator. It was like, okay, you know, I have all these ideas, or I think I have all these ideas, but I can't really interrogate them unless I have the language to. And so that really became an eye-opener for me, and it allowed me to express myself and just have more possibilities, you know?
I think that I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't like people with conspiracies because I think most of them are just well, it's too complex to have these conspiracies. But anyway, that's me. But having said that, the reason I'm so struck by this part of your book and this kind of pedagogic and philosophical concept you put out here is because it is very real. Because I think that is, you know, when I interview young people in schools, that's the first thing I think about. So I can see this brilliant brain working inside behind these eyes. But they don't have the language to discuss what they're really thinking. That's criminal.
And
it also destroys what the generation coming up.
Yeah, and I remember feeling like that when I was in high school. You know, the blank page is what saved my life. I was in class, and I had gotten kicked out of a couple of different schools in Philadelphia, and I wasn't very studious, and I was getting in trouble, and all types of things. And the book talks about all that. But there was a moment that really changed my life. A teacher put blank pieces of paper in front of everybody and told us to write. And, you know, of course, I didn't do it. and she came over to me and said, you know, write. I said, well, what do you want me to write? Because I was used to school being about rote memorization and regurgitation. Just tell me what to do and I'll do
it,
you
know?
And she said, well, write anything you want. And, yeah, I wasn't used to that. So, you know, of course, I challenged her at first with some curse words. And
On paper.
And she, you know, I wrote F school, actually. And so she said, you know, because at that time, you know, and this book really is about education. You know, it's about re-education, self-education, street education. It's about self-education. It's also about the difference between school and education. Because at that time, I was talking about school, not education, you know.
Right.
So she said, keep going. And so I kept going, and, you know, I turned the blank page over, and it was blank again. The blank page is the starter pistol that fires and triggers my mind to sprint. What will I write? What will I say? Will I write about what I say? Something funny? Something serious? How will I start? Whose story will I tell? My story? Something made up? What about a story about a boy from Philly? A lost boy who wants to find himself but doesn't know where to look. Who wants to tell his story but doesn't know where to begin or end. Who searches anyway and discovers something about himself, about the world. I stare at the blank page, an ocean of white, alive with possibility. I hear myself take a breath, then exhale, deep like I just rose from underwater. Mm. It's like I'm at the free throw line again. Foul shots, like the game is on the line again. I remember something my pops told me. Shoot to make it. My hand shaking, trembling now like it's freezing. Then it hits me. A silence louder than all the music I've ever heard in my life. All the light in the world in one beam before me. I grip the pen and something shoots down my spine. Sits me straight up. The pen feels heavy like it's made of stone. I stare deep into the blank page and see myself. I feel something I've never felt before. Purpose. I don't know what my exact purpose is yet, but I know it has something to do with this pen and this blank page. I am the blank page. Holding the pen this way, snug and firm in my fist, makes me feel like I can write my future, like I can spell out my destiny in sharp strokes. So that's, you know, a passage from the book where I kind of discovered the blank page, and it transforms my life, you know. I get into it. I learned that to be a good writer, you got to be a good reader. I start reading a book a day toward my final years of high school. A book a day.
I might read that. A book a day.
Yeah. I mean, that was what I set out to do that at the beginning.
So how much
of
your day did that take?
It depends on the book. I was generally reading smaller books, you know. I didn't read Crime and Punishment in a day.
Maybe 2 days.
Yeah. But that took a little longer. But yeah, but I was, you know, just devouring stuff. I was like someone who was, you know, in a desert thirsty. I hadn't been reading up until that point. So, this was all new to me. And I was also being exposed to authors. I mean, I opened up talking about Kerouac and Dharma Bums. Right. I was being exposed to writers from the Beat Generation and from the Black Arts Movement that really spoke to me. What they were saying resonated with me. It was different than a lot of the other things I had read in school. And that's really the motivation behind the reason why I wrote Buck, you know? I wanted to write something that could be that book for that 16-year-old, you know? The best compliment I've ever received as a writer was a guy who ran a prison, a juvenile detention center, telling me that he gives my books to kids who hate reading.
Mm.
And, you know, that really touched me because I think I was that kid. And I think it's not a rejection of anything intellectual. Sometimes it's a rejection of things that don't speak to you and don't speak to your soul and don't resonate with you. And, you know, I wanted to write something that resonated with the kids who might not be, you know, finding that book that they're being assigned in school, something that really relates to their life, you know?
I do know. I understand that. I mean, I'm you know, I'm interested in the books that you talk about because I think of your dad,
mm-hmm.
very clear about he thinks young Black folks should have as an education in terms of reading and where they should go.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the part in the book we talk about where you were actually sent to school, though.
Yeah, right. You know,
it's the contradictions that we all exist in, right?
Exactly. You know, who was it that said, you know, do I contradict myself? Of course I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes.
Right. Whitman.
Yeah, Whitman.
Yeah, Whitman,
I think Whitman
quote that
said
you use,
that.
Right. Yeah. So when you look at like a pantheon of literature that you think about our young people should read, what do you think about in that pantheon? I don't just go ahead.
It's diverse, you know. It's really diverse, you know. It goes through different eras, you know. So, you know, literature, I mean, we'd read classics, we'd read ancient texts, you know what I mean? We'd read all types of texts. We'd read, you know, even religious texts have lots of literary value there. In fact, a lot of our allusions and things come from literary texts, you know, whether it be Bhagavad Gita or the Bible or, you know, the Book of the Dead or any of these books. But also we would look at different, you know, movements within literature. You know, we'd look at, you know, so we talked about the Beats or the Harlem Renaissance or Black Arts Movement, all these different periods. But we'd also look at, literature from all over the world. You know, America has a lot of great writers and great writing that's come out of it, but great writing has come from all over the world. So it'd be diverse, you know. And even within America, looking at writers, you know, from different backgrounds, not even just kind of white and Black, you know.
Absolutely.
A lot of times we kind of, right. But you know, I mean, there's amazing Native. One of my favorite writers is Sherman Alexie.
I love Sherman.
American.
He's been on the show at least 8 times.
Really,
I love Sherman Alexie.
Oh, I
yeah.
love Sherman Alexie. That's my dude.
Yeah.
Shout out to Sherman Alexie. So yeah, I mean, you know, there's just so it would be broad and diverse, and you know, make people kind of think, which is the key.
So what did your what did your family think about how you wrote this book? Because you really were very open about the stuff your mom went through, the separation from your dad. And you say he loved you, always was there, was a great dad.
Yeah.
But it was like his went up when they split up.
Yeah.
What happened to your older brother? How things kind of fell apart.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was nervous at first. You know, this memoir was calling me. They say sometimes, you know, the book that you should write or the story you should tell is the one that you're kind of scared to tell because, you know, there's so much there and, you know, you don't want, you're worried about what this person's going to think or what this person's going to think. You know, you're the one that really, you think about it and it excites you, but at the same time, it scares you and it frightens you, you know. Buck was this book at first for me, you know, when the idea first started to, because it took me a while to be able to even have the courage to tell this story, you know. But as that idea began to kind of plant and take root in my mind, I was nervous at first about it. So I went to my family and I talked to each person individually. I kind of treat everybody, and everybody's their own entity, right? So this is my mom, this is my brother, this is my dad, and they don't really necessarily all communicate. So it's like each person has to. So I sat down with each of them, and, you know, one of the things I love about my family is I have a family of artists, essentially. You know, my brother is an artist, you know, in all ways.
He's in Philly now?
Yeah, he's in Philly now. My mom is a choreographer and a dancer.
Still?
Yeah, still. And my father is an artist in his own way, and he understands art. He's really more of a scholar, but he understands art and understands the need for people to tell their own story. He actually wrote a memoir a couple years ago called As I Run Toward Africa. And it's about kind of how he, you know, because he comes from one of 16 children, Valdosta, Georgia, and you know he became a pioneer of Raffles Centricity. So how did he get there? It's about that story. So they all understood the need for me to tell my story and all supported me and said, you know, you have to tell your story the way you want to tell your story. And it was just like I got the green light from everybody, you know. I told my dad, I said, you know, I'm going to use some of Mom's journal entries.
I know you did, yes.
Up in the book, and they're interspersed throughout. That's how I communicated with my mom back in the day. She would write journal entries. I would read them secretly, and, you know, I went to her, and she said I can use them in the book. So
yeah, and when you first went to your mom, after sneaking and reading her stuff without telling her,
yeah, I mean,
how was that?
You mean when I went to her when I was writing the book, or when I was young?
When you were young.
Oh well, when she found me reading it, and when she found that, she also found a lot of other things. At the time, you know, I was 16 years old. I was selling drugs. I was living a street life, and she found all that stuff in my room. And so I got kicked out of the house. You know, was a kind of a dramatic event. Yeah, so that's how she reacted back then. But now she totally understands the importance of what we went through. Again, no struggle, no progress. But also she understands the importance of those journal entries. You know, my mom was suicidal for a lot of that time that I write about in Buck. And she was on very strong medications and really dealing with depression in a very serious way. So, and now she's much better. And so she feels like using her journal entries, even though she wrote it just for herself back then, and I was reading it, which was one kind of, you know, breach of what she thought. But now the world is reading it. You know, this book is everywhere. I've got people sending me pictures of Buck in Nepal and Europe and Africa and stuff. So the world is reading her journal now. And but she loves it because she knows that it's actually helpful. It's instructive. It can help somebody else through their journey, because she talks about how she deals with pain and depression and all these serious issues that really don't get talked about sometimes, especially in the African-American community with regard to mental health. So she feels like she is, you know, even though on the one hand, whenever you open up your journal entries to the world, it's kind of, you know, unsettling. But at the same time, she feels incredibly empowered by it and that she's doing something that's going to uplift people.
How do you see, I mean, here I know at Morgan, you teach creative writing and film.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a discussion on the air. It'd be interesting to have you actually talk about this at some point in the air with us, just the idea of how you see the creative world, the world of art, the world of theater, the world of film, the world of poetry, the world of writing, how that fits into us understanding this social political world that we're stuck in, that we live in, and how we get through it. I mean, how do you see the role of art in all that?
Right, so now you're talking my language.
I know, that's why I'm asking you.
You know, and when I say language, it's really ironic, because that's actually how I think of art, as languages, you know, all these different things: film, theater, literature, poetry, you know, painting, visual art, mixed media, all the dance, all these things are languages, you know. I love language, actually, and we talked about language earlier. I love language. And so for me, you know, knowing the language of poetry or knowing the language of, you know, prose or film or cinema or dance or any of these things, it's like knowing a language, you know. It's like knowing French or Spanish or Swahili. It allows you to communicate with certain groups of people, you know. So certain people understand Swahili. And so if you go to Kenya, you start saying Asante Sana, Siki Tu, people know what you're talking about, right? Because they know the language. And to me, that's how art is. There's people who understand the language of poetry, of hip-hop, for example, right? There's language. There's a language, really. It's its own language, its own thing. Some people listen to it, they have no idea what's going on. Some people listen to it, and it completely resonates with them and connects with them because they understand that language, you know? And the language isn't just the words being said. It's how they're being said. It's the energy behind it. It's everything, right? And so these are different languages. As an artist, personally, I've always wanted to be multilingual as an artist, like in the Paul Robeson kind of tradition, right? Singing and acting being a lawyer and being a poet and
all
being an activist and really being an artivist. You know what I mean? You know,
how do you say say it?
Artivist. Artivism, right? Where we take art and activism and we merge them, where we understand that all art is political, even art that seems apolitical, because that's really just a support of the status quo, right? And so what I want to do as an artist is this, real quick. For, you know, I look at the African-American quilts that my ancestors made who were enslaved, and there's four things about the quilt that I think artists, we kind of strive to do. The first thing is we didn't have one big piece of cloth back then, so we would take, you know, a scrap here, cotton, you know, denim, all these different things, unite them, and out of, you know, nothing really make something, right? So that's a resourcefulness, the maximization of minimal resources. That's the first thing the quilt does. The second thing is the quilt is aesthetically beautiful. So even though it's all these scraps and stuff like that, it's still up to the highest aesthetic standards. The third thing about the quilt is it's practical. It's not made to just hang on a wall somewhere and not be actually used. It has a functionality in your life. It's art and it's beautiful, but it also will help keep you warm. You know what I mean? Uh-huh, uh-huh. And then the fourth thing about those specific quilts is those women would embed secret codes and messages onto the quilt, symbols. You know, so one, if you didn't know what it meant, if you didn't understand the language, then you wouldn't get it. But if you knew the language, you would know that, okay, this is a map for how to read the safe houses along the Underground Railroad, or this is a map to teach me how to read the stars so I can get free. So here you have a quilt made by African-American women who were enslaved that's resourceful, beautiful, practical, and emancipatory. It's a piece of art that can actually get you free. So for me, when you ask about the kind of convergence of all these things, that's what art should do. It should be beautiful. Truth and beauty, Keats, right? It should be beautiful, it should be truthful, it should be resourceful, and it should be emancipatory. It has to liberate.
So if you've never heard MK Asante's voice before, you just heard it now.
Young Buck, Buck Wild, Buck Shots, Bucktown, Slave Buck, Black Buck, Make Buck, Buck Now.
Buck, a memoir. And tomorrow night, 7:30, MK Asante will be talking about his memoir, Buck, at Red Emma's at 30 West North Avenue. More information at redemmas.org. That's redemmas.org. We'll also have it up on signoshow.org tomorrow night, 7:30, 30 West North Avenue.
And you could also go to mkasante.com and at mkasante on Twitter.
There you are. So be there and enjoy that tomorrow. It's going to be great. And we are going to set a time for MK to come back for an entire hour so we can just kick back and really get into this in a deeper way than we did today. Good to see you, brother.
Thank you so much, man. Great fat. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here.
Yeah.
We're going to a brief break. And when we come back, it's time for Sound Bites. Our weekly look at food, agriculture, the environment, our future. Stay with us. Don't go away.
Have come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner, and I